It's a great pleasure to welcome you to another episode of Across the Pond, where we discuss the big stories and top investment ideas from the Eurozone and Switzerland. Global equities are trading within a whisker of all-time highs, with the MSCI All Country World up almost 19% so far this year, and that's building on impressive gains of 20% and 16% in the prior 2 years. But the mood in markets is far from relaxed. Many investors are caught between two conflicting fears. The first is the fear of missing out as the AI revolution gains momentum. The second is the fear of an equity market bubble as stock valuations reach the highest level since the dot-com surge 25 years ago. So how worried should investors be by historically elevated equity valuations? I'm Christopher Swan.
And I'm Belinda Peters. And given that equities are most expensive in the US, does this mean that investors should be diversifying globally? And if so, where? Are higher cash balances a safer bet? Or should investors be looking at other asset classes for long-term returns? To take a stab at answering these big questions, we are delighted to welcome Kiran Ganesh, Global Head of Investment Communications. Thanks for joining us, Kiran.
Thanks. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
So Kiran, there's like a wide range of sort of weird and wonderful, exciting ways of valuing equities. What's our philosophy on these and how good are they? Do they work?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, there's definitely a lot of ways that you can go about trying to assess the valuation of a market. Of course, the purest way is to think about using like a discounted cash flow model, but this is pretty hard to standardize and do at a market level. So we tend to use some shorthands, so things like price to earnings ratio. But then you come into problems like how do you project earnings? We know that analysts can often get forecasts wrong, they tend to trend. So then you can look at trailing earnings, but then that doesn't tell you an awful lot about the future. Then you can look at things like cyclically adjusted PE, so you kind of go back over the past 10 years and try and smooth out earnings trends. But this also has problems because it doesn't adjust for structural changes and things like tax rates or interest rates or economic trends. And then that also brings you the problem of how you compare things against the other available options. So maybe valuations are high because bond yields are low, for example. So, you know, certainly lots of different ways to value stocks, but none of those are perfect. And of course, we have to come back to the question of, you know, are they actually any good, as you said, at judging future returns? When we look at the historic correlations, one-year PE ratios have a very, very weak relationship with forward returns, so effectively useless. And actually, often when PEs are rising, it's because there's something exciting happening and there's a reason and they continue to rise. The cyclically adjusted PE ratio does have some correlation to longer-term returns. So if we look at historic earnings, smooth them out, judge a valuation on that metric and look forward over the next 10 years, then that does tend to have some kind of correlation. But even this isn't a very tight relationship and certainly isn't the best guide to investment decision making. If you'd used the KPE and compared to its long-term averages, you wouldn't have been invested in the market for most of the last 30 years. And obviously that would have been quite a costly mistake.
Everybody has been, you know, talking about bubbles lately with equity valuations so elevated. But maybe we can start by outlining why this has become a mounting fear among investors.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at those simple PEs, then the S&P 500 is at around 23 times expected earnings. So that's about 38% above the median valuation over the past 30 years and is in the 99th percentile of valuations over the past several decades. So, you know, certainly higher than normal and, you know, almost higher than it has been at any point in the last 30 years. And if we look outside of the US, then we could also see that in Europe, Japan, China, emerging markets, not quite as overvalued compared to their own history, but also above long-term averages. And then I think there's been some valuation and bubble concerns that have also been emanating by some of the vendor financing that's been happening within the AI space recently. I think that's kind of creating some fears that, you know, perhaps this is all getting a bit too complicated, a bit too interlinked. And I think that raises some fears about things like bubbles as well. We've had various opinion leaders also commenting on bubbles. It's fairly routine nowadays to hear central bankers talking about bubble risks. We heard that from the IMF as well. So yeah, between valuations, commentary, and some of these financing agreements taking place, you know, I think there is, you know, valid reason why investors observing all this will be fearful that we might be entering a bubble here.
So, I mean, that combination sounds pretty ominous. So why is it that we don't think there's a bubble?
Well, I think there's a few things we can kind of quibble with. So I think the one on the valuation itself, there has been a structural shift in the composition of equity market indices over recent years. So they used to be quite heavily dominated by things like oil and banks, which are quite cyclical industries. So they usually warrant a lower valuation. Now, we've tilted more towards things like technology and communications, which tend to be a bit more subscription-based, more stable revenue streams. So perhaps they justify a higher valuation. So just because the index is now a bit more subscription-based and a bit less cyclical-based, you could say, okay, it deserves a bit of a higher valuation. And actually, if we adjust for that sector mix, then the MSCI All Country World Index, instead of trading on a current PE of 19.3 times, would be on 17.3 times. So still kind of expensive, but not quite as much. We can also say that valuations aren't quite as high as they have been in some previous bubbles. So if you look at the top tech firms today, they're trading on around 30 times PE. If we go back to 1999, at the peak of the dot-com bubble, they were trading on around 60 times PE. So yes, that's a little bit different. And we can also say that the economic backdrop is also a bit different to in the past. When bubbles have popped historically, there's usually been some kind of catalyst like rates rising or the economy slowing. But today, rates are falling and the economy is relatively resilient. So I think we can kind of point to a few individual quibbles. But probably the bigger question I ask back to people who are worried about bubbles is actually, is the debate even worthwhile? Because you can be absolutely right that the market's in a bubble, but still get the market call wrong. Or you could be wrong that the market's, you know, not in a bubble and it can still fall anyway. I mean, we've seen bear markets in the past from non-bubble points. I think the classic example of getting it wrong was Alan Greenspan, of course, who back in the mid-90s gave a very famous speech about irrational exuberance. And the market continued to rally for 3 or 4 years and actually didn't troughed at a higher level than when he gave the speech. So, you know, the bubble question, I think, is fraught with difficulty and you know, isn't necessarily a great guide to what you should do with your investments.
And maybe as a follow-up, you mentioned before in I think the first question, that valuations aren't a reliable predictor of short-term market returns, but over the long run, they could, you know, tend to be a much stronger guide for future performance. And what does that mean for investors, and where do you think they should put their money?
Yeah, so as I said, on that cyclically adjusted PE, there is some kind of guide to what it might mean for longer term returns. And, you know, it is fair to say that both valuations on that metric are high at the moment, and also that just returns in the past 10, 15 years have been really, really strong. Over the past 20 years, S&P 500 returns have averaged around 12%. So I think it's reasonable to expect that returns may be lower than what we've seen in the past 20 years in the next 10 or 20 years. But that also doesn't mean that returns can't still be strong. And, you know, if we are truly on the brink of AI changing the nature of the global economy and boosting productivity and giving all kinds of opportunities for companies to improve their margins, then yeah, the next 10, 20 years could be really exciting in terms of earnings growth and equity market returns as well. So yeah, reasonable to expect a bit lower returns, but it could still be good. I think for investors as well, you know, it may be also a good time to think about diversification. The US has been the place to be over the past 15, 20 years from an equity market perspective. There are other markets, of course, that have somewhat lower valuations. So I think if investors are overly concentrated in the US or technology as a result of the great performance that we've seen, maybe this is a decent time to just think about diversification and look to other markets like China, Europe or Japan, which have, you know, somewhat lower valuations.
And valuations aren't the only thing, right? I mean, we don't invest based on valuations alone. But are there specific areas outside of the US that aren't as expensive?
Yeah, so Europe is only around 6% above its long-term average valuation. Japan is actually 18% below its long-term average valuation. EM around 9% above. So, you know, these are all more or less in line with their kind of longer term averages, you know, maybe a little bit above. But the overseas markets certainly aren't quite as highly valued as the US. And I think if you look at a sector level, then you know it's the technology sector that's really trading well above its medians, and some of the other ones not trading quite so high relative to their own histories. So you know, none of this is to say that you shouldn't have exposure to the US, you shouldn't have exposure to tech. These are really core parts of a portfolio, and where frankly a lot of the excitement and the growth is going to come from in the next years from an earnings perspective. But I think thinking about diversification at this point, in light of the great performance we've seen, in light of those stronger valuations, I think does make some sense at this point.
So let's say we have some skeptics listening in who really don't buy any of this and really think this is a bubble. Obviously, the great temptation is to sort of shelter in cash and wait till there's greater certainty. What do you make of that approach?
Yeah, I mean, prepare for a potentially very long wait. I think that's really important to think about, because I think a lot of people go into this and think, okay, I'm just going to shelter in cash, and then the market's going to drop, and then I'm going to put the cash to work, and then the market's going to rally, and all will be well. But you know, typically, things don't work like that, right? So, I mean, maybe just as a thought exercise, like imagine we can all agree that the markets are going to be, I don't know, 50% higher in 10 years' time. But you get a question, how do we get there, right? Maybe it does take the path that you would enjoy in a way. If you're a cash holder and it crashes in the next 1 or 2 years, you can deploy the cash and benefit from a rally back. But you know, also that 50% gain over the next 10 years could be realized within the next two. You know, perhaps there's a lot of excitement over AI, and then maybe it kind of range trades after that as we kind of digest the growth in AI. Or maybe an even more risky outcome, maybe we have a huge bubble over the next few years and maybe it doubles, and then investors who hold in cash kind of panic that they're missing out on something, put the money in, and then it crashes later, right? So there are all kinds of behavioral risks with having excess cash, and you could just be sitting waiting for a very long time for the right time to get in. And I think maybe many investors over the past few years have kind of experienced that, because markets have been pretty consistently moving upwards. So, you know, really, we think the best thing to do is think about what is your ideal strategic asset allocation. Probably that doesn't have a very high amount of cash, because cash over the long term is a drag on performance. And then think about how can you get to that strategic asset allocation in a reasonable amount of time. You know, it doesn't necessarily make sense to just jump to it immediately, but using things like phasing strategies over time to get towards that over a 1 or 2 year horizon, I think is a good way to, you know, get yourself out of this kind of behavioral trap of holding too much cash, get yourself towards a portfolio that makes a bit more sense, and end up with a strategic asset allocation that really sets you up for longer term success.
All right. I think you've now managed to talk us out of bank deposits. But for investors who still feel, you know, the need for some safety in their portfolio, what are other alternatives they could consider?
Yeah, well, I don't want to completely talk people out of bank deposits, because yeah, I think having some cash in the portfolio is of course important. We know that bear markets do happen. It can take, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years to recover from those bear markets. So having some cash in the portfolio that can cover you for that period when you might need to withdraw, I think is important to stop you needing to sell assets perhaps at depressed prices. So cash is important, but just limit it to only the next sort of 2 to 5 years of withdrawals, we would say. But yeah, for other stuff, quality bonds we think are good. You know, from a credit perspective, similar risk to cash. They do of course move up and down with interest rates, but that can be pretty favorable, because often if the economy is slowing and equity markets are dropping, then bonds are also rallying. So unlike cash, they can perform well during periods of market uncertainty rather than just staying flat like cash does. Then there's other stuff like gold, and that's done really well over the past year, I think, as we may have all seen. But we still think that can be an effective hedge against fears about inflation, fears about geopolitics, and tends to do well during those times. So a kind of interesting alternative hedge. And then while volatility is low, then that may also create opportunities for investors to think about more direct means of hedging. So structured strategies tend to be cheaper when volatility is low, so people can hedge their equity exposure more directly. So there are a bunch of ways to think about how to improve diversification and hedge against potential risks if people fear them.
And so just to round off in a sort of broader, more philosophical sense of sort of how you manage your portfolio in times where sort of bubble fears are sort of prominent, you know, what kinds of strategies should investors be considering?
Yeah, so I think just very tangibly, get that core allocation right. So think about what proportions of equities, bonds, alternatives makes sense for you and try and move towards that. Also make sure that within each of those, within equities, within bonds, within alternatives, that you are diversifying properly, whether that's across regions or across sectors or across strategies or credit ratings, diversify properly, you know, within those, because, you know, bubble risks will often be concentrated in individual areas, I think, as we've discussed. So diversifying is a good way to help mitigate some of those risks. Think about hedging in some of the areas I talked about. So whether it's gold or structured strategies or quality bonds, you know, that they can help a portfolio. And then think about a rebalancing strategy. So what are you going to do if the market falls 10% next month? What are you going to do if it rallies 10% next month? Often a good approach is to think about, okay, I'm going to set my equity allocation at a certain level, so say 60%, let's say. And then if the market rallies, of course, that allocation will start to increase. But then maybe that's a good opportunity for you to systematically take some profits, bring it back down to 60, or vice versa. If it crashes and your equity allocation starts to fall, then that's a good opportunity for you to gradually grow your equity allocation. So having a systematic rebalancing strategy, I think, is a great thing to have in place and just build up that discipline. But yeah, I mean, I think maybe just to go back to the philosophical perspective, I think, you know, keeping your eyes on the long term, I think, is really important in all of this. Markets are very volatile in the short term. We know this. They can rally sharply. They can crash. But I think if investors can really keep an eye on what they're trying to achieve over the next 10 to 20 years and invest with that in mind, then they're playing a game that they can win, whereas that short-term trading is just extremely difficult to navigate. So just keeping that long-term perspective, I think, is really important.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you so much, Kieran, for joining us today. And thanks to our listeners as well. We can delve into specific securities on these podcasts, but you can explore some of these with your UBS representative. But just to sum up here, while we don't believe US stocks are in a bubble, elevated valuations mean long-term investors should also consider looking beyond their home market. We recommend focusing on sectors and regions exposed to secular growth, such as China tech, Japan, and select emerging markets. Diversification remains key. Broadening exposure to areas like global banks, utilities, and healthcare, and balancing your portfolio with fixed income, gold, and private markets can help manage risk. Looking ahead, staying invested and globally diversified should position you well for the evolving market environment. We'll be back soon with another installment of Across the Pond. In the meantime, have a great week.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.